Good afternoon. My name's Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. And on behalf of our congressional leadership, Senator Rockefeller and Senator Collins, and our board of directors, I want to welcome you to this briefing on how the Medicaid program that finances health and long-term care for vulnerable Americans is affected by and has an impact on an economy that shows unmistakable signs of slowing down. Our partner today is the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, which is a project of the Kaiser Family Foundation, which in turn does so much useful work in both health policy and communications. You'll be hearing from the Commission's Executive Director, Diane Rowland, in just a moment. You know, Medicaid sometimes gets overlooked in health policy discussions in this town, which, when you think about it, is kind of an unusual occurrence, or should be an unusual occurrence. The Medicaid program is huge. In fiscal 2008, more than $350 billion. We used to say it had overtaken Medicare, but you folks who put Part D in place kind of reshifted the balance a little bit, for at least for the moment. Medicaid covers more than 50 million people. That's one out of every six Americans. And in that respect, it is bigger than Medicare. So when the economy starts to fault and people start losing their jobs, more people become eligible for Medicaid. That makes the program more expensive at the very time when state governments, which are, of course, required to balance their budgets every year, start losing revenues. So it really raises some substantial dilemmas for those involved with the program. We're going to hear a discussion about these problems from a number of different perspectives this afternoon. So at this point, let me take the occasion to recognize my co-moderator and Kaiser Commission Executive Director, Diane Rowland. Her very impressive biographical notes are in your materials. Let me just say, it's a real pleasure to have, and a comfort to have, one of the nation's most respected authorities on health policy moderating the discussion with me to bail me out. Diane, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Ed, and thank you for being so generous in your comments. I think as we gather today in this historic room, it really is also part of the message of this briefing today, which is that history tends to repeat itself, and let us hopefully learn lessons from the last time that we can apply to the next time. And so as we face yet another economic downturn and we look at the stress and strain that that puts on state budgets and on the operation of the Medicaid program, I think we can look back and take some lessons from the last economic downturn and the fiscal stimulus package that was put together there. I also think that it's, you know, worth remembering, we tend to think about Medicaid, as Ed talked about it, in terms of the 50 million beneficiaries who depend on it, those who are uninsured that may potentially become eligible for the program. But we also have to remember that it's a major part of the economy, and it's a major part of the economy of many small communities and towns around the country. And I was reminded once when testifying before the Virginia legislature, I was talking about the impact of Medicaid cuts, and one of the senators looked up and said, but that's the hospital in my community that employs the most people. That's the pharmacy where most people work. And so as we look at these issues, we need to look at them both from the perspective of the program and the role it plays for the people it serves, but also for its overall impact on the economy. So I'm really pleased that we have such a great panel today to really share with you some of their thoughts and their insights on where we are today with regard to Medicaid and the economy and where we ought to be going. So without further ado, I'll turn it back to my co-moderator. Thank you.
Thanks, Diane. A couple of logistical notes before we go forward. Many of you who are regulars at these briefings have heard them before, but bear with us. There are some new folks. By Tuesday morning, you'll be able to view a webcast of this briefing, thanks to KaiserNetwork.org, a project of the Kaiser Family Foundation. And in a few days, you'll also be able to see a transcript, both on the KaiserNetwork.org website and on the Alliance's allhealth.org website, along with electronic copies of all of the materials that you have in your packets, and in fact more, because we have a PowerPoint presentation that wasn't available in advance that will get posted on our website right after the briefing. We're going to ask you to be an active part in this discussion once we get the presentations on the table. There are floor microphones, there are green cards in your materials that you can write questions on and have brought forward, so don't be reluctant to ask tough questions in a civil way. And finally, we just ask you to take a second to turn your cell phones to vibrate or off so that you won't have to worry about people criticizing your choice in rings in the course of the briefing. Now, we've got some very impressive speakers today, and more than we usually have. So I appreciate they're all coming together to help us grapple with these complicated and interrelated problems. I apologize for not being able to give them the introductions they deserve just because of the need for brevity. And I would urge all of you in using these microphones, because the acoustics in this room are not that great, there are a lot of echoes around, that you get as close as you can comfortably get so that you can hear every precious word in the back of the room. With that practical advice, let me turn to our leadoff speaker. We're really pleased to have Dennis Smith filling that role. Dennis is the director of the Center for Medicaid and State Operations within the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services at HHS. His not very difficult job is to oversee the Medicaid program, which actually many people describe as not one but 50 or more programs that are very different from place to place, along with other non-controversial activities like the SCHIP program and others like that. Now, some of you may not know that before he came to CMS, Dennis was in charge of the Medicaid program in Virginia, so he has experience from both ends of this federal-state relationship, and we're really glad that you were able to join us today, Dennis, to get this discussion off on the right foot.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be with everyone this afternoon and congratulate the Alliance on putting together such an impressive panel. I'd like to sort of just sit here and listen to them all afternoon, but to earn my lunch, I guess I have to say a few words. I'm happy to do so. As Ed mentioned, sort of Medicaid creeped up on policymakers and folks, I think, in many respects, didn't quite fully understand the growth in the Medicaid program. Medicare is the big game in town because the federal government finances all of its costs and runs the whole program, et cetera, versus Medicaid, to where 43% of the funding of the program is not in the federal budget. So it doesn't look as big here in Washington. But putting together, of course, Medicaid is going to spend about $350 billion this year, of which about $200 billion from the federal government, and is projected to spend state and federal combined over $2 trillion over the next 5 years, over $5 trillion between 2009 and 2018. I think to some extent it has been stuck in my head. Last weekend I saw Charlie Wilson's War, and one of the I think underlying themes of the movie, of course, is also how Washington works. And one of the things that struck me was the very modest $5 million first appropriation that they were looking for, and it got doubled to 10, et cetera. And they went back, sort of reflecting back on it, is, well, how did this happen? And basically the message was, well, nobody was watching. To some extent, the growth in Medicaid has happened much in the same way. It has been sort of out of sight. It's grown over time, both in terms of increased eligibility, as was mentioned. We now have, between SCHIP and Medicaid combined, 36 million kids who are served at some point in time, which is more than the actual number of kids below 200% of poverty in the United States. Roughly, there are 30.2 million kids below 200% of poverty, yet we have 36 million that we have served at least part of the year. So I think that, again, it's kind of when people hear about what Medicaid does for the first time, Medicaid has been given many different tasks. It started as a low-income program for individuals on the old AFDC program, people who were on welfare, people with disabilities and our senior citizens who didn't have the means to pay for their long-term care. It was the essential part of the program. But we've heard things again over time, like income disregards was really part of the lexicon last year in the SCHIP debate, where income disregards started out in the old welfare programs to provide incentives for people who were already on welfare, trying to help them get into the workforce and leave the workforce eventually. So it was a way of gradually getting them into the workforce, helping to provide support over time. Now we've sort of turned it on its head and used income disregards exactly the opposite way to get higher income people eligible for the programs. The current situation in terms of the FMAP and the situations that the states face today, I really think are different than earlier this decade when a temporary FMAP was provided. In the sort of the old model, states basically had three choices to make when they were facing hard economic times. What would they do in the Medicaid program? Essentially, their choices were cut eligibility, cut benefits, or cut payments to providers. But since that time, and since the last FMAP increase, we saw the passage of the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005, which has given states many of the tools that they had long asked for. So one of the, I think, important considerations now is states now have more options to deal with their Medicaid program in the control of the program. We have seen some change over time, greater use. We've seen a great deal of growth in the managed care in the Medicaid program, but other things like disease management. So the states have more tools to deal with the challenges than they did, I think, last time around. Also, and again, I think the historical relationship between Medicaid and the economy, to where enrollment was sensitive to what was going on in the economy, unemployment in particular. But this decade, we saw that even after states came out of more difficult times and the economy got better, enrollment continued to grow. And usually you would have seen the relationship as the economy had difficulties, the enrollment would go up, things would get better, then enrollment would go back down. We didn't see that this time. Enrollment stayed the same. Oftentimes, I think to a large extent, states should be congratulated for their role in the leadership role that they have taken in trying to reform our healthcare system and to expand health insurance coverage. But what worked well for the lower income categories, we can do things differently, though, as you get into the higher income levels, things like cost sharing, for example. And we have seen states now, we have a state in the SCHIP program currently covering at 300% of the poverty level with a premium of $80 a month. that the state now wants to cut that in half. You know, at $80 a month, coverage was, I think, arguably very affordable for a family making more than $60,000 a year. So what is the rationale for simply saying we're just going to cut that participation in half? We've asked the state. We're sort of still waiting for a good response. Lastly, let me touch, as I'm seeing my time run down, touch on regulations that have been a popular topic of discussion here lately. And again, to sort of put these in perspective, the savings associated with the regulations is little under $14 billion over a five-year period of time. So again, put that in the context of a $200 billion program in itself. And in many respects, as we have seen, we get sort of go back and forth with the states where there's a lot of focus on the new rules. When you go back and look through inspector general audits, for example, of state programs in these different areas, the states weren't meeting the old rules. So in large part, the challenge was the new rules are sort of getting blamed for things that wouldn't have been allowed under the old rules had they been appropriately enforced. So I think that the issue to some extent is coming down to the enforcement issue. And at the federal level, keeping the partnership intact of the funding of the program and the responsibility of the program. So my time has expired here, and look forward to your questions.
Thank you so much, Dennis. Now we're going to hear from John Holohan, who directs the Health Policy Research Center at the Urban Institute. John's done more analyses of Medicaid and state health policy than almost anyone around, and he's among the most respected voices on these topics. So we're very happy to have you back on an Alliance panel, John.
There we go. I think I got it. Okay, so I'm going to talk about some work that we've been doing with support from Diane and the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured on the effects of an economic downturn on Medicaid, SCHIP, the uninsured, both coverage and costs. This is a joint product. Stan Dorn, my colleague at the Urban Institute, has sort of led this effort, but Bone Garrett and Amy Williams and I have also been helping out. So let's go back over the sort of the basics, a downturn, how it affects health coverage, unemployment, and related pressures on business. It causes many people to lose their employer-sponsored insurance. Those who lose that either become uninsured, which increases state and local costs of uncompensated care. They enroll in Medicaid or SCHIP, which increases state spending, or they get some other kind of coverage. And at the same time, and pretty importantly, it turns out, states experience revenue declines that affect their ability to pay for Medicaid and to pay for uncompensated care. These are some results from work that has been done by Bowen Garrett, one of the co-authors. And it's an econometric estimate of the impact of a 1 percentage point increase in the unemployment rate, the number of children and adults with various types of coverage. If you look at kids, the model predicts that you'd see a drop with a 1 percentage point increase in the unemployment rate, and that's probably about what we're looking at. In January, the unemployment rate is 4.9%. The forecast that I've seen range from 5.5 to 6.5. So a 1 percentage point increase is useful to look at here. You'd see a drop of 700,000 children. Most of these would get picked up by Medicaid because Medicaid does such an extra together. Does such a has such broad coverage for low-income children. For adults, it would be a drop of 1.7 million, 400,000 picked up by Medicaid, 1.1 million uninsured overall, an increase in Medicaid of 1 million, increase in number of uninsured of 1.1 million. We then tried to project what that would mean in terms of Medicaid spending. The numbers at the far right-hand side there show the baseline where we were in 2008, $335.2 billion, total spending, $142.9 state. We project, and this is based on the changes in coverage, our estimates of costs based on 2008 numbers, adjusted for the fact that we're likely to see less healthy or more healthy people come in than those who are on the rolls right now. The state costs from this will go up by $1.4 billion, overall 3.4, a 1% increase in overall spending. But an economic downturn has more implications for Medicaid than that. It'll have a pretty sharp increase or decrease or adverse effect on state revenues. A colleague of ours at the Urban Institute, Kim Rubin, has done a different econometric study that looks at the impact of unemployment on state revenue. Her findings are that a 1 percentage point increase in the unemployment rate reduces state revenues by 3 to 4%. Now, if you assume that all states must balance their budget and that all spending is cut proportionally, then Medicaid and SCHIP would face cuts on the same magnitude, 3 to 4%. So revenue loss is really a bigger fiscal problem for Medicaid than increased enrollment. Together, these two studies would say that states face about a $5.5 billion to $6.5 billion problem from just related to Medicaid from each 1 percentage point increase in unemployment. So what does this mean for state budgets? I think it was said earlier by Ed that states, almost all states have to, by law, balance their budgets. To do this, the behavior of states is to get into rainy day funds or reserves, borrow from trust funds, securitize future revenue streams that states have done through tobacco settlement funds, or they push spending into the next year. But once they get past that and the ability to continue to do those things, then they start to increase taxes or cut spending on Medicaid or college education, aid to localities, and things like that. These latter actions, not the former, but the latter ones, are pro-cyclical. That is, they offset what the federal government is trying to do, and they worsen the economic downturn. So in the last recession, there was legislation passed that provided fiscal relief to states. Part of this was in block grants, $10 billion. The other part in increasing the federal matching payments by 2.95 percentage points over a 15-month period. The main stipulation was the states had to agree not to reduce eligibility standards below prior levels. And the effects of this were reasonably good. States did not cut Medicaid eligibility during this period. It prevented a lot of other cuts, although there were some made to benefits and provider payment rates. But I think there were two problems. One is the delay in reaching federal agreement. Let me stay there for a second. But it meant that the delay in getting the legislation passed meant that many states had already made a lot of cuts before the fiscal relief was available. The stimulus needs to be quicker and more automatic for it to have the effects that we want. And then states vary a lot in the length and depth of an economic downturn, as well as when those downturns begin and when they end. So a single uniform FMAP adjustment, as the last time, means that some states actually received windfalls and were able to use the money to build up rainy day funds or reserves. And other states got a lot less help than they needed, or they got it after they needed it. So it was both poorly timed and poorly targeted. And this slide is one way of looking at this, that unemployment rates at the end of last year vary tremendously across states. If you look at changes between the beginning of 07 and the end, you see a comparable picture, considerable variation of how much unemployment rates have gone up. Some actually have gone down. But there are states at the tail that have had greater than a 1 percentage point increase just in 07. And this is before we're all thinking that this recession was coming. So what to do about it? We could do what we did the last time, a uniform FMAP increase for all states, the amount and duration determined through the legislation. Essentially, all states are treated the same regardless of their circumstances, the depth of the recession, how long it should last, and so forth. We think we should be thinking about an alternative that would provide federal funds based on changes in unemployment. The GAO has written on this. That's one possible way to do it. It's essentially a national trigger. Unemployment goes up by a certain amount at the national level, but then the funds are distributed depending on the depth of, depending on state circumstances, how badly off a particular state is But I think even though there are a lot of ways to do this, I think the principles here are these, that the assistance needs to vary with the depth and the length of an individual state's downturn. It needs to begin and end based on the state unemployment changes, the individual states, and that the funds need to be large enough to offset not only the increased enrollment, which are actually reasonably small, but also the fact that the revenue loss affects states' ability to support the base Medicaid program. So to sum it up, when an economy declines, Medicaid and SCHIP enrollment goes up, costs go up, but at the same time state revenues are falling, number of uninsured, which I haven't really spent any time on, but that goes up too, creating a different kind of fiscal problem for state and local governments. To balance their budgets, states, though, have to cut back on Medicaid. This could adversely affect the stimulus we're trying to get out of federal policy. The legislation last time in 03 and 04 did a good job of preserving Medicaid eligibility, and it helped states avoid many of the cuts they might have otherwise had to make, but not all. And in part, this is due to the fact that it's a relatively crude mechanism and not well targeted. So as we get into a new downturn, we're going to recommend that the Congress actually design a stimulus package, but that have it be much better in terms of its timeliness and how well it's targeted. I'll close with that. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Very broad, a very good piece of background and overview as well. And I'm going to dig out my notes. Next up is Jim Froege. He's the project director at the Center for Health Transformation, an enterprise with which former Speaker Newt Gingrich has some vague connection. He focuses on Medicaid and state health policy there. Before joining the center, Jim's worked with market-oriented state legislators on health issues at the American Legislative Exchange Council, and he's also a veteran of several different Hill staffs and a previous alliance program, so we're very pleased to have you back. Jim?
Well, thank you very much, Ed. I appreciate the invitation to be here and for you covering such an important topic. I think Dennis, in his remarks, said something that gets to the heart of the comments that I want to make, which is about the movie Charlie Wilson's War. My first year on Capitol Hill, to date myself a bit, was 1996, and I was a lowly staff assistant. And even back then, I remember hearing stories about this legendary character named Charlie Wilson and all the activities he got away with. And if you've seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about. And I looked forward to many of those activities myself as I rose in the ranks on Capitol Hill. And alas, the movie was somewhat more exciting than the reality. When we talk about health transformation, we talk about a healthcare system that's entirely different than the one that we have today. One of the key qualities of a 21st century intelligent health system is transparency. The right to know costs and quality outcomes of all healthcare providers. The trend toward transparency is everywhere. Our government is becoming more and more transparent every day, and one of the best examples of this in recent years is the transparency bill passed by Senators Coburn and Obama, that $1 trillion in federal, there has to be one portal on the OMB website for people to search $1 trillion in federal spending. That's exactly the kind of reform we want to see. Senator Obama is the most liberal senator. Senator Coburn is very likely the most conservative senator, and this is something on which they could agree. Campaign finance laws that require disclosure of everything over $200, even your salaries on Legistorm, which if there's anyone who doesn't know that, I'm sure that's the first website you'll search when you get back to your office. Yes, you can find the salary of every one of your colleagues anywhere on the Hill. In Florida, they have a website called floridahealthfinder.gov, which I would encourage you to take a look at, where you can find cost and quality information, outcomes, results for every hospital in the state. It costs the state a couple $100,000 a year total to put up this very powerful sunlight effect. And by the way, 93% of people think they have the, quote, right to know cost and quality information about healthcare providers. The Medicaid federal match, I won't spend much time on it, but the way the federal match works, the dynamics, the incentives it sets in place, all but guarantees ever higher spending. It's an open-ended match, anywhere between 50 and 76%. And there's a whole industry of lawyers and consultants in this town who make hundreds of millions of dollars teaching states how to game the federal match. I'm sure Dennis Smith, once he retires and steps down and has a few drinks, may want to write a book about this. The incentives for states are for every dollar of Medicaid spending, they get 1 to 3, quote, free federal dollars. Of course, that assumes that the taxpayers in the state don't also pay federal taxes. To save a dollar in a state budget means leaving 1 to 3 federal dollars on the table. And as a result, state spending on Medicaid has gone up as a proportion of their state budget for 40 years. And that trend will certainly continue. Medicaid is crowding out education, law enforcement, highways, environmental protection, and any other state spending priority. But the federal Medicaid match isn't going to be fixed anytime soon. So what to do? Well, to walk you through one slide to illustrate what I'm talking about, let's talk about Medicaid fraud in New York State. New York has by far the highest absolute and per capita Medicaid spend of any state. 13% of federal dollars go to a state with 6% of the population. A New York Times study in 2005 in July found that there was one Brooklyn dentist who billed for 991 dental procedures in one day. Now, there is not a McDonald's anywhere in the world that would sell 991 phantom cheeseburgers in a day, for comparison. James Mehmet, who's the former Inspector General of New York Medicaid, said, quote, this is in the article, 40% of claims are questionable. There was a private study done in 2006 that has never seen the light of day. They're the first outsiders to ever look at New York's claims. They found 1/4 of that program cannot be explained. Now, New York Medicaid, give or take, is about $50 billion a year. So that's $12.5 billion in probably outright fraud. Amusingly, the Federal Medicaid Commission started in the summer of 2005, and they had a year and a half to come up with ideas on how to save $10 billion from the federal spend over the next few years. And instead of looking at New York Medicaid fraud, in which they could have found all of that in 2 years in one state alone, they recommended all kinds of hits to honest providers. Perhaps I can suggest a future Alliance for Health Reform event on ideas to combat Medicaid fraud, because there's quite a bit of it. And the ultimate people that get hit are the providers and, more importantly, the patients who see their access to care restricted. We actually did a back-of-the-envelope calculation last summer. This is not scientific, so I'm telling you it's back-of-the-envelope. But if you took Arizona's Medicaid system, which is arguably the best run in the state, in the country, and applied the principles of the Arizona Medicaid, the management of Arizona Medicaid to New York, you'd probably save at least $10 billion a year. Arizona, by the way, has the highest Medicaid reimbursement rates in the country, the most satisfied providers, most satisfied patients. They have a very good rural access, and it's a program that just works very, very well. So, what to do? Well, if Congress is considering a bailout of states, it's appropriate for Congress to have an ask. In any relationship, whether it's your husband or wife or state to state or business to business, the relationship appropriately is give and take. So what can Congress ask? Well, how about as a condition of accepting bailout money, states must post all provider bills online for public access in real time. A little Coburn Obama for Medicaid. Now, I haven't spoken with anyone in Senator Obama or Senator Coburn's offices, so they're not endorsing this. I'm just saying the principles that underlie what they pass for federal spending are appropriate for Medicaid. So if you submit claims to Medicaid as a provider in your state, that claim goes online in real time as soon as possible. I mean, real time would be real time, but in some cases there's paper bills and some delays at hospitals and cases, so it might be something that can't go exactly real time, but close would be very helpful. So how do you do this? Work with states and provider groups to create low-cost, administratively simple way for provider billing to go online in real time. To get started, I understand this is a very sweeping proposal, but in 8 minutes or less, I'm just talking about the concept here in the Q&A, we can get into more details. But at the very least, you could talk about 10 or 20 high-volume services or procedures that are susceptible to fraud. You could limit it to fee-for-service Medicaid. but areas where there's a lot of fraud, for example, durable medical equipment, transportation services, CAT scans and imaging, injectable drugs, there's a lengthy list. And if you put sources and uses of state Medicaid funds and taxpayer dollars, Dennis, I'm sure it's not something that you'd want to deal with, but it would be quite a sunlight effect. So why would this work? Well, more sunlight is always better. In-state, in-house fraud monitoring can never be as good as the collective wisdom of interested academics, researchers, other clinicians, and providers from all over the country. People who could look at these bills, make sense of them, and know that this particular provider's 3, 4, 5 standard deviations for the mean from their practice in their area for their area of specialty. And taxpayers have a right to know how their dollars are being spent. Fraudsters may know how to beat the locals, but there's no way they can beat the collective wisdom of everyone who's involved. I see my time is up, but I want one more slide to run through. I would take it that you, when you get back to the office, Google Gold Corp Challenge. This is an example of this concept in practice, not in healthcare, but in another industry. We can talk about it in the Q&A, where they posted their data online and just had an absolutely stunning return, far beyond the wildest positive suggestions. So who should support this concept? Well, with modesty firmly in check, every honest provider of Medicaid services, every Medicaid patient advocacy group, every taxpayer, and every elected official who has an interest in eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse. One cannot solve a problem with the same thinking that created it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. Sounds like a unanimous consent request to me. You know, we try very hard at the Alliance for Health Reform to make this a forum in which people don't have to worry about being blindsided by partisanship. Our next speaker, Ray Shapak of the National Governors Association, has been doing that kind of delicate balancing act for the last 25 years. As executive director of the NGA, Ray has a new chairman, one from a different party from his previous chairman. Was it every year?
Every year.
It helps that he's a respected economist. Very comfortable saying, on the one hand, X, and on the other hand, Y. But he's here to give us some one-handed remarks about Medicaid and the economy, and we're very pleased to have you, Ray.
Thank you, Ed. Just wanted to follow up on Jim's comments a little bit. And if we see the federal contribution and growth rate to Medicaid jump next year, it's probably that Dennis Smith did not, in fact, go write that book, but he's out working for states. I'd like to cover four items real quickly. One, what is the current fiscal condition of state? Second, why will it worsen over the next year to 15 months? Three, why does the state impact lag the overall economy? And what are some potential policy responses? First, end-of-year balances have been coming down quite dramatically. As of 2006, they were over 11%. As of about 4 to 5 months ago, they were down to 6%. I suspect they're in the 4 to 5% range right now. Second of all, spending has been coming down. Average growth rate of state budgets over the long run is about 6.5%. Spending for 2008 in governor's budgets is about 4.7%. We did a very quick estimate based on a survey of states about 2 weeks ago. What is the current shortfall? We've got 18 states with about $14 billion shortfall for 2008. Most states are on a July to July. And we've got another 18 states that have shortfalls of about $32 billion for 2009. So it's beginning to increase. Clearly, 6 or 7 states, I think, are in recession. California, Florida, Arizona, Nevada, Michigan, perhaps Minnesota. Those are a lot of the states that rode the housing bubble up, and they're riding it back down. We do have a small group of farm and energy states that are doing fine. The rest in the middle, I think, have now realized that they're, in fact, on the way down. Our best estimate on the sales tax revenue growth, which normally, again, grows 6.5%, is down in the 1% to 2% range now, and a number of states seeing negative. We always see the downturn in sales taxes before we see it in income taxes, which normally tracks unemployment. There's another impact out there that most people aren't talking about much, and that's the local government impact, which I would argue is going to be quite significant, particularly in these states, because property tax revenues are going to go down quite dramatically, although that's going to lag, and the place that local government comes is actually to states for bailout. So this, I think, will in fact elongate this downturn. Based on those estimates that I gave you in terms of the fiscal condition, I would argue that within the next 6 months, we will probably have 35 to 40 states with shortfalls. And the reason for that is that it does, in fact, lag. If you look at the last two recessions, the one in 1991, we had 28 states cut budgets in the year that the recession ended. The following year, we had 35 states cut budgets. In 2001, the year it ended, we had 16 states cut budgets. For the next 2 years, we had 37 states cut budgets. Now, you ask the reason, why does that happen? Essentially because you get a reduction in the sales tax early. You don't really begin to lose the income taxes until you get unemployment, which is normally coincidental or even lags, depending upon the recession. And then the Medicaid growth rate normally comes in towards the end of that downturn. So that is the normal cycle of it, and that's why the major impact on states is not coincidental with the year that the recession is terminated, but it's the subsequent 2 years. And although economists have a fancy definition of recession, normally they only last 9, 10, maybe 12 months. But the impact on states can normally be a 2 to 2.5 to 3 year period. One of the major reasons for resisting states is that state activity is pro-cyclical. Because of the balanced budget requirements of the 49 out of 50, Vermont is the only one who doesn't have a requirement, but they tend to be fairly fiscally conservative anyway. But to meet the balanced budget requirements, they have to either cut spending or raise revenues, both of which are pro-cyclical, meaning they make the downturn more severe and longer. And therefore, giving state aid so that you don't have to make those cuts is normally considered a fairly positive counter-cyclical approach. It's not just NGA that says this. If you look at CBO or if you look at Mark Zandi, economy.com, they will argue that state fiscal, it may not be as good as highly targeted income rebates, but it does trump most of the business types of deductions that are in the normal stimulus plan. So I wouldn't say it's a number one, but it's clearly in that second category. What we put on the table this last time was something similar to what we had enacted in 2003. It was a combination of increases of $6 billion in FMAP and $6 billion in block grant. One of the major reasons we put the block grant component on the table is that we have to remember that these subprime loans are going to continue to trigger over the next year and a half, which means this situation, even with a 30-day moratorium and so on, is probably going to continue to deteriorate. And we do have a number of states that are actually out working with neighborhoods, counseling, working with lenders and so on, trying to keep people in those particular homes. And some additional money in block granting, we think, actually measures a positive thing in terms of prevention from allowing this thing to deteriorate further. This is very similar to what we had enacted in 2003. Which is very good in that all the rules and everything are previously been worked out on both the block grant and the FMAP. The FMAP is very good because it can be done immediately, and as soon as that's enacted, you don't have to wait for money to flow. Governors automatically begin to change planning horizons, and they won't make the cuts of the Medicaid and the other places that are need to. So it's one of the few that is very, very fast. In some ways, a lot faster. It's going to take us 4 months to get the checks out on rebates. FMAP goes in immediately, so it's a fairly positive type of thing. The only thing I would say in terms of the negative, I'd probably agree with John. The secret here is if we could make it more highly targeted, it would help those individual states, number one, and number two, it would be a more effective countercyclical. In fact, I would probably argue it might even trump rebates to individuals if you could target it on those states that, in fact, need it most. I will return my 37 seconds.
Thanks very much, Ray. Our final speaker is the very patient Barbara Edwards, the director of health services at the American Public Human Services Association, which means that she is in charge of the National Association of State Medicaid Directors. She has a lot of practical and analytical experience with the Medicaid program, having run the Ohio Medicaid program for 8 years and helping other Medicaid programs, not just in her current role, but before that as an associate with one of the most respected firms doing Medicaid consulting work in the country, Health Management Associates. So she brings a variety of experience and expertise to us, and we're very pleased to have you back, Barbara.
Thank you very much. Actually, I'm not patient. I'm sitting here like Dennis. I'm taking notes like crazy from all these really smart people on this panel. I really appreciate having the opportunity to share with you today sort of the down and dirty frontline experience of what it's like running the Medicaid program when the economy goes soft. And the reality is that many directors in the country have a lot more experience with this right now than they are happy with having. Just a few slides. The first is sort of some of the numbers I think are most helpful for you to take away from what you've heard today. And you've heard some of these numbers already, but I think it's important. First of all, Medicaid by the numbers, 50 million covered lives. About half of those are children, but 70% of the spending is being driven not by the children, not by the low-income parents that are covered by the program, but by the elderly and people of all ages who have chronic or disabling conditions. So when you think about Medicaid, it's easy to think working families and folks who get cash assistance. The reality is the money in the program is being driven by people with disabling chronic conditions, including the elderly. And in fact, 40% of the spending in this program across the country is for people who already have Medicare health insurance. And that's something I wish people in this room would take a moment to think about. Particularly when, as Dennis said, Medicaid sometimes gets overlooked and maybe not attention paid inside the Beltway. The fact is 40% of the spending is for people that are insured primarily through Medicare. And those two programs, in fact, are not aggressively engaged in finding more effective and efficient ways to deliver services. There are some activities, but this is a huge overlooked area where I think there's potential for enormous real savings and better outcome for people in the program. So, 50 million covered lives, most of the dollars are being spent on people with chronic and disabling conditions, 40% for people that have Medicare, so they're not even uninsured by anybody's count. And Medicaid is a huge part of states' budgets, 20 to 25% depending upon the state. And because the cost of health care is growing faster than state revenues, it in fact takes a larger share of many state budgets on an ongoing basis. Medicaid, in average, the federal-state split, and this does vary from state to state and from year to year, is about 60 cents federal dollar, 40 cents state dollars. Varies from 50-50 to much higher federal match rates. And that has some big implications for states as they face downturns as well. The other thing I want to just mention to this audience is that in the idea that Medicaid sort of started as a companion piece to welfare and cash assistance and some of the old forms of social services. The fact is, today in almost every state, the number of people who receive Medicaid, a Medicaid health card, who are also getting cash assistance is probably less than 25% of the total enrolled population. So again, this is in fact a very different program than it was when it started. It is a health insurance, a health coverage plan, and it is a major one in the country. So what happens when the economy slows? This is my very simple picture of what you've been hearing from all these very smart people up here. The economy slows, Medicaid is countercyclical. As people lose jobs, or if they lose health coverage because their employer is cutting back on those services in a bad economy, more people become eligible for Medicaid. The demand grows at just the moment the state can least afford to pay for it. When Medicaid grows, it's such a big piece of the budget that it puts immediate pressure on state budgets and can be a part of what drives deficits for state budgets. As you've heard people say, states don't have a choice. They have to balance the budget, and they have to balance it in the fiscal year. They can't wait. They can't average it out over a few years when things are a little bit better. They have to balance it now, which means they need things they can do now that change the spending before the end of the year. There's not time to reform the program. There's not time to start a public process. There's not time to have a negotiation with CMS about some of the wonderful new things in the system. And the fact is, most states are already doing managed care. They've already taken advantage of many of the options for managing the program more effectively. That's what they budgeted for, was that new reformed system. And so when the economy changes and the demand for Medicaid changes, they still have a fiscal problem, even if it's Arizona that's running a wonderful Medicaid program. So when states have those fiscal deficits, the first thing they cut may not be the Medicaid program because there is that federal revenue that's associated with it. But eventually, it's such a big piece of the budget, you've got to pay attention to it and make changes to the spending in that program, particularly if there's been a, as many states have experienced, a long period of economic slowdown in the last recession where they cut everything else already. And there's not much left if you don't start going into Medicaid. The thing to keep in mind is that from the state's perspective, to get a dollar savings in state general revenue funds, you have to cut $2.40 out of the Medicaid program if you're a state with a 60% federal match. So the size of the program cuts you have to put in place to get the dollar of state savings out is much larger than what you save at the state level. Federal government also does some savings in that. Maybe that's a good thing. But it's a much bigger impact to health care and to the program than in a program that was fully funded at the state level. What happens from that is that there is basically a multiplier effect in terms of the impact, in terms of the lost revenue to the local providers, who are in many communities the largest employer sector. So you have sort of, to get a little bit of savings at the state level, a much bigger cut in Medicaid that has in turn a further slow down impact on those local economies. And so it is sort of a downward spiral. And that's my very not an economist view of the world. The federal impact on this kind of a cycle can kind of take place in two places. One is if the federal revenue is further pulled back through federal policy action, either because regulatory changes make federal dollars less available, or because the FMAP gets reduced, for example, and there are some proposals on the table to do that, that can speed up this process of putting the state in a fiscal challenge, causing the state to look at cuts, causing local economies to lose even more dollars, and further increasing the challenge. When states look at the idea of a stimulus, basically what it's saying is the other way the federal policy can impact is to intervene between the fiscal problem and the Medicaid cut and hopefully prevent that cut, keep the dollars, at least stabilize the program so that you don't further reduce the spending in the healthcare sector. And it, by the way, create more uninsured people and add more pressure in the system that way. In case people sort of think because of this federal dollar that's out there, states don't cut the Medicaid program, the fact is they do. And in fact, the experience that states had over the last recession, and these are data that show state activity from fiscal year 02 to fiscal year 06 in terms of cost containment for Medicaid, show the kinds of activities that every state in the country implemented, and then sometimes year after year during that downward cycle. As Dennis mentioned earlier, the things you can do to produce a short-term cut in spending is to reduce what you pay to providers, reduce the number of people that you insure, or reduce the benefits that you buy. The other kinds of reforms, whether it's for transformation, whether it's to fundamentally redesign the program, put even more people in managed care, those are very good ideas. In some cases, they don't happen within the same fiscal year in which you start that work. So to do something to meet that fiscal challenge, states have to do sometimes give up those federal dollars in order to save the state dollars, and they do that through rate cuts, restricting who's covered and restricting the benefits. So for Medicaid directors, these are times of high stress. It's high stress on the programs. And frankly, the larger reforms in the program are more likely to occur when the economy is stable and people have the time and the resources to make some of the investments that you need to make to support strong reform and transformation. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Barbara. We've had I took a lot of notes myself. And learned a lot. Now you get a chance to join the conversation. Barbara's slides will be on our website as early as the close of business today, so you can download those if you want to at allhealth.org or kaisernetwork.org. Ray mentioned an article by an economist named Zandi. I think you'll find those in your materials and on the website as well. And I neglected to mention, by the way, just in passing, that we'd very much like you to fill out those blue evaluation forms that are in your packets so that we can improve these programs in the future. We have microphones, to which already we have someone repaired. We have the green question cards that you can fill out and hold up, and someone will bring it forward. So let's get started. Yes, would you identify yourself?
My name is John Green from the National Association of Health Underwriters. Some questions for Ray. I read in the Washington Post recently about my state of Maryland that they discussed how in good times they expand populations and they spend the money as fast as they can get it because it seems that constituents want them to. So when there's a downturn, they don't have any money for bad times. And I'm wondering if... You know, I remember attending one of these the last time we had this problem. And I know I appreciate Barbara's comments about we don't have time for that. But going forward, what about having a rainy day fund for Medicaid and putting money aside for when there are bad times instead of, you know, depending on the federal government for, quote, bailout?
I don't think states have done rainy day funds for a particular program, but virtually every state has a rainy day fund. They access them differently. Sometimes it can be accessed by the governor. Sometimes you need legislative approval. Sometimes it's a hybrid. You can access it up to a certain amount. But the last two downturns, states had between 11% and 12% rainy day funds of spending. And so I think they've been fairly good about trying to build those in good times. They have to, you know, governors have to deal with legislatures too. And when you start getting a rainy day fund above 10, 11, 12%, you do get a lot of pressure from the legislature to, in fact, spend goods. I think they're fairly responsible on it. The last downturn we had in 2001, from a state perspective, was the worst downturn since the Second World War. I mean, revenues went negative by about 7.5% for a couple of quarters. That almost never happens. You know? And as of 2006, they had 11 to 12% surpluses again. Now it's been eroding as the economy has been slowing. But I think they've been pretty responsible.
Sue Ellen Galbraith with Anchor. An easy reg question for you, Dennis, because it's not one of the ones in the current topic of discussion. Final reg projections for coming out on, for lack of another words, the private provider tax reg. And then just as a general comment, You know, it's always interesting to me when so much emphasis is placed on the cost of Medicaid, its rising growth rate and spending, when in fact the conversation ought to be around, I'm blaming you all, the conversation ought to be around, in general, the rising cost of health care and how much of every individual's budget or family or state and other state operated programs, how much of that is affected by the cost of health care in general. Thanks, Dennis.
Your question is, when will the final reg come out? Soon.
Definitive. Diane?
We have two questions here that really relate to the concept of state forecasting of Medicaid expenditures. One directed, Barbara, at you or at Ray, for how do states forecast Medicaid expenditures? Are they comfortable with the tools they have to do that? And Dennis, does CMS provide any assistance to the states in helping them forecast Medicaid expenditures?
Well, I'll take a stab at that. And some, I think, in fact, many states feel pretty comfortable about the ability to forecast Medicaid, except when something changes dramatically. I know in Ohio's experience, it was a pretty sophisticated process. It wasn't someone just taking last year's spending and say, oh, I think let's raise it by 6%. Projections were done at a rate cell level, at a category level. There were many models run, and there was a pretty sophisticated forecasting process that was used. And the reality is, in any forecasting, you're having to make assumptions. You have to make many assumptions around the Medicaid forecasting models. And there are the things that make the biggest difference if you get it a little bit wrong. Caseload is one of the biggest ones. And that really is triggered then by whether or not you got the economic forecast correctly pegged. And lots of people have trouble with that, particularly predicting exactly when the bubble's going to burst, exactly when something is going to change that's going to dramatically increase or decrease. Obviously, the decrease is much more of a problem from a budgeting perspective if the economy drops. So I think states, and states probably vary in this, but states are pretty sophisticated around this. It's such a big part of their budget. It's not as though they're cavalier about it. But this really gets down to how well anybody is able to truly predict the economic future of any state. And if we were all better than that, we'd probably all be richer than we are.
Generally, we do not, because the states have the information and have it on a much more real-time basis than we do. Forecasting back in Virginia, for example, I mean, we used very specific things that Virginia knew, but HCFA at the time would not have known. So, but states do use, you know, national health expenditures. So they use resources in terms of what is generally available, but for their own forecasts, they'd be more direct than that. We do look at the draws, again, Medicaid on a quarterly basis when states are drawing down. And if there are sort of big swings one way or another, we'd certainly contact the state trying to figure out why. Here and there, you get into a situation where you start seeing some things that we would contact states. They themselves may or may not have a good explanation as to really what's behind their numbers, but generally they're so much closer than we are, it's almost exclusively a state.
I'm Bob Hall with the American Academy of Pediatrics. I want to thank the Alliance so much for having this meeting on Medicaid. We love Medicaid. It works very well for children, and actually there are problems, of course, and one of those problems is that from the provider's perspective, the pediatrician's perspective, on average we get paid about 70% or a little lower than Medicare under the Medicaid and CHIP programs. We try to stretch that as far as we can in terms of providing medical homes to children, but we're very concerned about what's going to be happening this year coming up. As you put on one of the slides, every single state cut provider payments as a result of decreases in Medicaid funding and resources. One of the things that was in a couple of the bills last year that didn't make it through was a was an idea of a Medicaid MedPAC. Essentially, I think it was called the CAPE and the CHAMP Act, and it was also in the original Senate bill that looked at this. I know that there was a discussion of this in front of the Medicaid Commission 2 years ago, and I'm wondering what the panelists feels about this, or what the panelists feel about this. We've been in favor of this for a long time. Certainly folks in this room get, you know, twice yearly reports in the Medicare program about where savings could be achieved, you know, where funding should be increased, et cetera. But I think there's always been this sort of state-federal dance that goes on in the Medicaid program that's very different than the Medicare program. So in the interest of full disclosure, in the interest of sunlight, what do folks think about that?
Well, I guess everybody's looking down here. I don't think that would be a particularly effective thing to do. Federal dollars follow state dollars. The states make the decision. It is a decision that is made in state capitals and the men and women who get elected to make those decisions about reimbursement rates for this provider or that provider. I think at the national level, it would be, you know, sort of a centipede tripping over all of its legs. To relate what's going on at the national level to what a specific state, I just don't think would be particularly productive.
Anybody else? Jim?
Just add as a broad comment, kids are cheap. And there's a lot of kids, and women and children are 60, 70, 80% of people in Medicaid, but they're very cheap. Expensive, as Barbara said, long-term care, people with multiple chronic conditions, the same people year in and year out, and fraud. Barbara also made the correct observation that most states, when they look at what to do about Medicaid, cut people, cut benefit rates, or cut rates, or cut benefits. Rates, benefits, and people. Well, what about going after fraud? I mean, if fraud were attacked in a meaningful way, and it were as much as it appears to be, there would be a lot more money left over for things specifically like pediatrics, not to mention many other areas.
John?
Oh, go ahead. Sorry. Let John go.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that minimum standards for provider payments, particularly doctors and hospitals, is a good idea. I think that is... I would support that and have written that in different places. I think that the big issue, and because this has come up before, in Medicaid costs is not in those populations. It is really in the disabled and elderly and the population that share between Medicaid and Medicare. There's just an enormous amount of money spent on those populations, and for the people at the tail of the spending distribution, an incredibly high amount per person. And I think we can just do a much better job of managing the care that those people get and save money. And that, just to look anyplace else, given the history of Medicaid and how states have cut provider payment rates, dealt with benefit issues and things like that, it just is foolish. That's where the money is, and that's where the emphasis, I think, has to be.
You know, just in a couple of comments, one is that actually the interesting thing is states probably pay pediatric providers better than they pay most other community-based providers. So one of the challenges for states, and I think there are clearly states that are taking a hard look at how they could make a stronger investment in particularly primary care and community-based care in terms of reimbursement. The challenge, of course, is where does the dollar come from that brings you to that standard? It's not free. And if you believe that the dollars are in the system, you've got to figure out how to get it out before you can reinvest it. And so the challenge here is sort of the chicken and the egg. Where do you start in this? Because it isn't free to do that, and you've got to either pull the money from someplace else in the system, which is easier said than done, or you have to find more money, which is even harder. So I think that what the idea of a more efficient and effective system, if it would free up those dollars, the challenge often is providers will argue, well, you have to give me more money first before I'm going to be able to produce that more efficient and effective system. And so you've got this problem of how do you get started on that. I think with the issue of can you find more money from fraud, frankly, I think states believe the stronger place to place the investment is to prevent the bad dollar from going out in the first place, because the pay and chase actually doesn't get you much back by the time you go through the legal system to prove fraud and then try to find a dollar left in that provider's pocket to get back. It's not fast. It's very complicated. I think so you are finding states making much heavier investments in finding more effective upfront editing and screens and cost sharing. Some of the changes Congress made recently to try to make it to require that other third-party payers collaborate more effectively with Medicaid around third-party coverage, those kinds of things can be very effective at preventing the dollar from going out in the first place. And I think that's where a lot more energy needs to be placed so that those dollars are more immediately available to invest in more effective places.
My name is Brendan Connor. I'm from the Men's Health Network. I just wanted to pick up on something that you were talking about, John, in terms of the number of people who are going to need to access Medicaid if there is a downturn. Do you have any information on what those people will look like in terms of gender, race, ethnicity, and other sorts of demographic breakdowns like that?
With Bowen Garrett to see whether that can be pulled out of the data that he used. I suspect it can, but I'm not sure.
I'm State Representative Gail Harrell, Chairman of the Health Quality Committee in the state of Florida. I deal with this problem every single day. Florida has 2.2 million people on Medicaid. We have had increasing Medicaid costs to the sum of increases of 16% to 17% per year. We recently did some Medicaid reform and had a huge bill 2 years ago dealing with Medicaid reform. And I believe that this has enabled us to stabilize our budgets. And I would ask that as the federal government looks at whether it's FMAP or where you go with this, that you also look at, again, under the DRA or other legislation, to look at things to free up states to be more creative, more inventive in how we use those Medicaid dollars. And don't tie our hands in strict allocations and pots of money. Let us do those creative things. The incentive side of things is so much more effective in dealing with fraud, for instance, Jim. We have put in place 3,000 PDAs to our highest prescribing Medicaid providers. What that has done is has reduced our spend, our Medicaid prescription spend significantly by 17%, because not only are we tracking fraud, eliminating those duplications and doctor shopping that went on in things like controlled substances and OxyContin, things of that sort, but also it gave us the ability to bounce those medications off our PDL so that we then incentivize the physicians to use the PDL, choose the correct prescription. It also gave us the ability to prevent adverse reactions and adverse incidents and duplications and interactions of medications. So flexibility gives states the ability to help deal with this problem, and I would really suggest that that be the direction we look also.
Do you have enough experience to have a sense of which of the tools you put in place got you the most bang for the buck?
Certainly the PDA program gave us a huge, huge return on investment. For a minimal amount of money, we could place 3,000 PDAs. We did a pilot program with 1,000 to start with, and every year we've added 1,000 since we started doing that. And it has really created, it really has assisted us in our drug spend tremendously. Also, different things that we are doing through a Medicaid reform program in two different areas of the state has really enabled us through a variety of mechanisms to really stabilize our costs. And we're not seeing the tremendous increases. We haven't seen reductions, and that's not our goal. Our goal is simply to not have our increases at the rate that we were. We want to make sure that our patients get the very best care possible, but that every dollar is spent as carefully as possible.
Reactions?
Yeah, I take just
folks?
A second,
yes, Dennis.
Please. And maybe I can say this, Barb doesn't have to. One of the places I would urge states not to look for savings is on the administrative side of their program. States need to invest more in well-qualified staff who are able to write an RFP for managed care, who can write contracts, who can do the oversight, et cetera. Again, having come from a state, I know that sort of the easy, quick places that you look are, well, we'll put a freeze over here, we'll do an across-the-board reduction in administrative costs. States need to invest in their administration of the program. And part of that, again, is where we see ourselves today. Again, sort of in the good times, or in the better times, for state budgets, that was the time to do the planning. That was the time to do the investment. That was the time to, I mean, again, it is difficult to say now we want to do something to on cost sharing. Well, if your Medicaid management information system can't handle it, you have maybe wanted to do a policy option, but operational, you can't support it. So that's why I would urge states to not look at cutting back on the expertise that they need to manage these programs. Again, these are 20 to 25% of states' entire budgets. These are huge economic issues to the states. You need well-qualified people to be running these programs.
I would absolutely agree with you. And I think going a step further with that, I think we need to look at how we can really incentivize providers, incentivize new programs that deal, that have the outcomes. And we need to look at outcomes and be outcome focused in reducing those costs and making the very best use of each dollar. And that is certainly one of them.
Hi, I'm Brandon Clark. I work with the Energy and Commerce Committee in the House. I have a two-part question. First part is for Ray. I understand that the Deficit Reduction Act, the Medicaid reforms in that bill, were largely based on the unanimous recommendations of the NGA, the vast majority of those, and that those were largely based on the state's experience from 2001 on the economic downturn. Now that we may be going into another economic downturn, is it possible that you see more states taking up some of these state plan options? And the second part of my question would be for Dennis. Since these are state plan options, how quickly can CMS turn around an SPA from a state? So I know there was some discussion earlier about, you know, we might need to put more money into the FMAP because no other mechanism would be quickly implemented. And so I was going to see how quickly that you guys could turn around an SPA.
I would say yes. The DRA, we were the driving force on getting those particular changes, and it was pretty much unanimous within our organization. I would say that they were not necessarily a reflection of what they needed for downturn, in all honesty. They were more longer-run good policies, I suspect. But I do believe that you will see them increase dramatically over the next year because it is an option to save money. So I think it'll probably accelerate, and they will probably stay as more permanent policies for those states that implement them.
Dennis?
In terms of how fast we are, generally we're pretty fast. Thinking of some of the benefit flexibilities that we did with states, Idaho, West Virginia, those were pretty quick approvals, relatively speaking. Again, a lot of it is how prepared is the state on their end to be able to put their state plan amendment together. But certainly, we are available to help states draft their state plan to accomplish what they want to do. So I don't want the we will certainly do our part to assist states in technical assistance and quick turnaround.
Barbara?
Thank you very much.
I was just going to say, I think Dennis made a good point that I think in Idaho, in West Virginia, and some of those early states, there was a quick turnaround, but it had been a fairly lengthy process at the state level of gaining the level of consensus and political support to be able to support some of those changes. So it really does take, I mean, it is, Dennis is right, when the times are better is the time to really get started on those kinds of activities.
This is a similar question for Dennis. In your statement, you indicated that the flexibility
afforded to states through the Deficit Reduction Act could help state fiscal problems during the economic downturn. What flexibility are you specifically referring to, and are you suggesting that this flexibility alone can mitigate states' economic concerns?
Well, there are a number of different parts of the DRA. I think all of them working together can have significant savings for the states, and we have seen this on the long-term care side, as Barb has mentioned. Again, people with generally the long-term care side of the program, people with disabilities who are sort of the large cost drivers. But children, though, I think Jim mentioned earlier, kids are cheap. Well, that is generally the perspective and generally the idea. But also, even kids now, the estimated per capita cost for 2009 for a child full year on Medicaid is now $2,900, federal and state combined. I think a lot of the flexibilities on managed care, it is generally seen as an avenue that has been used by states and used successfully, both to increase access, to improve quality of care, and to generate savings. But, as I mentioned earlier, if you don't have the expertise to negotiate a good contract to protect the state, then in the end, it's not going to save you. Again, if you've created something that where you're paying PMPMs and yet you have carved out services that or don't have effective networks to where people are still ending up in the emergency room, still driving up fee-for-service costs, then the policy was the right thing to do, but it was you didn't execute it very well. People with home and community-based services, which the DRA makes it simpler for states to do. We have one state so far that has done the 1915i state plan option. More states should be looking at that option in serving people in their own home. A quick win right off the top on selective contracting. Again, an area where Jim mentioned places in fraud. You're doing selective contracting, putting certain services out to bid, ancillary services, DME, transportation, et cetera. Those are all good places for states to be looked at to where you're using competition to drive healthcare savings. But oftentimes what we find in healthcare, and it's not unique to Medicaid by any means, again, there's a lot of pressure. Sometimes you very much find you've come up with a cost-saving idea, and yet then other provider communities, other constituencies in the provider group say, well, that's a loss of revenue to me. So what are you going to do to make that up? So oftentimes we do end up paying. We don't generate the savings because we haven't moved the money. We've moved part of the money, and yet we're still propping up somebody else along the way. It does take, the idea of competition is that you're going to use the marketplace to drive for a better value. But if you then turn around and give it back through another way, then no, that's not going to save you money.
This question is, given the difficulties in stabilizing state revenues, state budgets, and Medicaid spending over the long term, do you, as the panel, believe it is feasible to look to states to implement universal health care programs for their population, or do we need to turn to national efforts? I.e., what are the lessons of this experience for state health reforms?
Barbara?
You know, I'm going to be brave and say something about this, though I probably shouldn't. I think that's okay. That's a good point. I think states will continue to try, and I think they will continue to bring energy to this issue, and we will learn from their experiences, and we will learn from their successes and perhaps from their failures. I think we are kidding ourselves if we don't deal with the fact that most of the dollars in the healthcare system are controlled by federal policy, one way or another. The Medicare dollar, the Medicaid dollar, the funds for people who are in the public, the services, the armed services, retiree assistance from the federal government, the ERISA provisions of the law. Most of the dollars in the healthcare system have federal policy constraining what states can do around those dollars. So I think we shouldn't kid ourselves that it can be done just by states. There's got to be supportive and compatible federal policy to, if you want to see states actually be able to move forward more aggressively.
I might comment in the area too. A lot of states, the pendulum on healthcare reform has swung back and forth between state leadership and federal leadership several times. Before President Clinton was elected, we had a lot of state experimentation, and when it appeared that the federal government was going to do it, all of that stopped. And now we're in another period of acceleration. I think what's changed, however, from a gubernatorial standpoint, is they no longer believe that the federal government is going to do it. So regardless of what happens, you're going to see a continuation of reform. That's broadly. It's around insurance reform. It's around health IT. It's around quality and so on. But the truth of the matter is there's not enough money in the system in most states. You'll notice that the only states that have gone aggressively have been Massachusetts and Maine and Vermont, states that had originally a very high percentage coverage. But I think even Massachusetts now is struggling to fully implement the system because of the budget. And we all know that California basically had to pull back because of their funding. I would hope we'd reach a point, in all honesty, where we would move together. It seems to me there's a number of areas that the federal government needs to move. They need to move on standards of health IT. They need to move, I would agree with Jim, on certain standards with respect to quality. I would hope that they would move in terms of price transparency. They need to build that infrastructure for the system. And second, they need to put some money for low-income people on the table. It can be tax credits, it can be vouchers, it can give the state the ability to choose between doing a government program or doing a private program. But I think we need to reach a point where we move together. The federal government needs to move on the infrastructure. I think they need to have the states have a lot of flexibility to move forward then. And I'm fine with the federal government coming around and creating uniformity across states after the fact where, in fact, we need it. I think one of the errors that we often make is we try to create uniformity on the front end of that. But what's happening in the states, in my mind, is both supportive of national reform and could become an obstacle to national reform. It's supportive because I think states have moved forward and they've shown the way in a lot of areas, and that's a very positive type of thing. But I think some of them are also a little bit reluctant to give up now that they've progressed on reform because the federal government would end up preempting them across the board. And I think we have to look at healthcare reform really through this federalism prism, probably more so in this area than almost any other joint partnership that we have with the federal government.
Jim? Add quickly that one of the problems any state has with being first in creating a universal coverage option of some kind is that it becomes very hard to sustain that pool. If you suddenly have a universal program in Oregon or California or Massachusetts, or when you saw Tennessee's very aggressive expansions in the 90s, there were serious problems with pooling and attracting some very high-cost people. It only takes a small handful to make that pool unsustainable, and I think you saw a lot of that. But I think Ray touched on something that's exactly right, which is a lot of states are doing a lot of good things. A lot of states are doing a lot of bad things. A lot of what we try and do at the Center for Health Transformation is work with states to talk about things that are working in other states. We try and be somewhat positive in a subject where there's an awful lot of negativity and pessimism. There are states that are doing very good things. There are states like Arizona that have had a great Medicaid program in place for 30 years, 25 years. That's been working very well, where reimbursement rates are high, providers are happy, patients are happy, rural access is good. There are models out there that are successful. So when you hear about those, share them with the National Governor Association or share them with us or share this with someone, because there's not enough communication between states along things that are actually working and producing better health outcomes at lower cost. And one final quick mention, I just think this is so important, is always keep in mind how few people and how few providers are such a substantial part of the cost drivers. It is hard to emphasize enough how few people and how few providers. It's now, these numbers vary by state, of course, but it's roughly 5% of patients that are 50% of the cost. If you look at the data at a very micro level, the county level, the zip code level, you can find providers that are way, way, way out to the right end of the bell curve on the charges they send to the states. If you want to look down to the people level, and by the way, I should say, with always the strictest guidelines for patient privacy, but you can find patients that are in the emergency room 200 times a year that could be much better served and much healthier if they had more care coordination. So instead of focusing on cutting reimbursement rates to all pediatricians, for example, states can do a much better job as aggressively going after providers that may be doing things they shouldn't be doing, or helping patients who are not getting good coordinated care because they're showing up in emergency rooms all the time with getting the right care at the right time so they're healthier and everyone saves money.
We have only a couple minutes, so Diane's got a bunch of questions on cards. Let me just take a moment to suggest that you use part of your attention over these last 5 minutes to fill out your blue evaluation form. Yes, Diane?
And we certainly couldn't have this forum come to an end without the questions that have been posed by many to Dennis, to Ray, and to Barbara about the impact of the recent regulations put out by the administration with regard to Medicaid and SCHIP and their impact on states' ability to be able to respond to the economic downturn. And as the economy softens, shouldn't one revisit these regs is one question. And another is, shouldn't there be a moratorium as we look at countercyclical relief for states? So you can answer it. Dennis, Ray, Barbara, you're the three online for this question.
I'll let ladies go first.
They know my answer. Let me.
Maybe I should just go ahead and jump in. Or Ray, did you want to say something first? Or?
I'll go after you, Dennis.
No doubt. Again, the regulations that we have promulgated in terms of the cost rule, the cost rule is a rule that is designed to protect providers. In the California financing waiver, revenues to hospitals went up by 12%. We're looking at the situation in New York now, to where New York City now wants money back from the Health and Hospital Corporation, money that we insisted should go to the provider and stay with them. So we think those are good things for the providers. If you've delivered a Medicaid service to a Medicaid recipient, you should get paid for it. And it should not be your obligation as a provider to pay the state or local government's share of the cost of the Medicaid program. Some of these rules do go about to what is the partnership. Is the partnership in Medicaid intact or not? And if you can't provider tax that was brought up earlier, it is a unique situation, I would think, to when someone steps forward and says, please tax me. You have to sort of wonder what's going on in when somebody says, please tax me, that where we have seen in the provider tax situation of how then dollars get moved around in such a way that I think is not good for the Medicaid program. In terms of other rules that we have, the cost rule embodies policies that the GAO has been recommending since 1994. So I would people say, well, let's put it off a little longer. I think we comes a point in time we really do need to get these in place for for the good of the program, because otherwise this tug of war that goes on constantly between the states and the federal government is not really a good thing. I mean, it is, you know, but we keep doing this, and we need to find a way to resolve it. In terms of the other regs, targeted case management, for example, in some respects, we know states are very concerned in contacting their delegation. In many respects, the impact of targeted case management was the new rules are less of an issue than whether the state was really abiding by the old rules. And where, you know, GAO audits that occurred before we even proposed the rule of where states were funding different other programs not related to Medicaid but using Medicaid dollars, their problem really was the old rules. But they were, and sometimes, and I have to say, frankly, also, I think we're obligated to step forward and say, we see what's going on here, and we need to do something about it. One of the common defenses of the state when you go into these audits is, well, the rules weren't clear. Well, okay, now we're trying to make certain the rules are clear, and that seems to be a problem too. We're kind of stuck coming and going on that one. In terms of the August 17th memo, again, poor kids first. That's who Medicaid and SCHIP were designed for. We feel very strongly that those low-income children should not be left behind before a state gets enhanced match rate going to higher income levels. So we think it is the right thing to do for the integrity of the program. We're in contact with the states on how to implement the August 17th. We believe more states will be in compliance with the 95% threshold than states are often given credit for. I think we need to move forward on resolving these things. Otherwise, we're just going to be in the same place just 6 months or 12 months or 18 months later, and that's not really what the program needs. The program needs this kind of stability, so we put sort of the tugs of war behind us.
Anybody else?
Yeah. Okay. I probably agree with Dennis's first comment, is that there is a lot of tension and pushing between states and federal governments, and we don't come to the table with 100% clean hands either. I think at times we push costs out of the federal government, and then the federal government pushes back to us. And I think, unfortunately, it would be better if we had a more trustful relationship so that we would move together on these things. And I don't want to talk about good or bad, but I will say that there's six or seven of these where the cumulative impact is probably about $13 billion over 5 years from OMB's standpoint, and many of our large states have estimated significantly higher costs to the implementation of these. So it's going to drain off a lot of people who are going to be working on this as opposed to other things they're going to have to do in the downturn. So it's a cumulative nature of these and the potential cost, which we think is a pretty significant problem. We also think in some areas they may have overreached the intent of the legislation and so on. And it's one of the reasons, in all honesty, when we did DRA, when we got unanimous agreement, one of our standards was all of the options that we advocated save both the federal government and states money. There was nothing that we put forward that essentially pushed more cost to the federal government. So I think we need to get to a point that we're talking about a more efficient program saving money for both levels of government.
Okay. Well, that sounds like a thoughtful last word to me, Ray. Thank you very much. We have run out of time, but I think we have not run out of topic for discussion, and I know that this is going to continue in a variety of fora over the next few months, if not beyond. I want to take this chance to thank both Diane personally and the Kaiser Family Foundation and its Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured for participation and support and sponsorship of this event as well. I want to thank you for being an active part of this dialogue. I thought it was a very enlightening one. And I want to ask you to join me in thanking the panelists for making a very diverse and useful transition.